Hi, Mark.
Hey, Jay.
Hi, Cryptos.
Hello.
Welcome.
So, in typical 2-bit Jay style, I had all these plans. We had set this conversation up before the holidays, and very blessed and honored to have you here, Cryptos. Of course, we'll get to the meat of the conversation that I had planned, which is talking about conservatism or the death of conservatism in the West, breaking the liberal frame, and maybe talking about a post-liberal or post-right solutions to what's happening in the world today. However, last night we suddenly there are giants in the
giant
world.
Aliens.
Giant aliens, right, giant Nephilim.
I've made my conclusions already.
Made the
days of Noah are quickly approaching. So we'll play through this clip. As always, let me know when you stop. It's a bit of a long one, so we might skip through a little bit. If people aren't aware, this face is just crazy, lady. This is almost discrediting. When I first crossed my desk, I would have discounted it completely if it hadn't come from Matt Erickson, King Build friend of our show. So,
because I found the same one on Twitter, and I was like, is that on purpose with the ring lights in the glasses? Is that a thing that I'm not aware of? You should put them right in front of your face.
It's a
nice reflection. It helps you look sane and qualified, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. The Google, the bug-eyed eyes, that really also help too as well.
It goes perfectly with that hairdo.
Yeah.
I think she's going for that sort of like, what's the term? It's like you can be
crazy,
crazy, incredulously dismissive, or you know, it's sort of like the Alex Jones thing. Like she can't pull full yelling, so she's going with this kind of look.
They call that half retard,
right?
Wow.
Okay, so we'll play a little bit, and again, stop me when you want me to stop, because I think this might throw a monkey wrench into everything here.
Yeah, go for it.
Or the fact that something like this could happen in our world, and not a single news media has broke this story, not at all. In fact, if you Google search it, it is quite a difficult find, which is all that much more suspicious with a story of this kind of size, this magnitude. And yet, here we are. Hang on to your britches. It's going to get real. A couple of days in Miami, Florida, at a mall, the local police were dispatched to the mall for an argument, a fight that broke out between juveniles. Juveniles, they say, had sticks. And fireworks. Oh my. But ultimately the call, what they claim was the call, the reason for the police officers to arrive at the scene, was due to a fight that had broken out between juveniles who had sticks and fireworks. But Auntie, why do you care if that's on the news? That isn't a big deal. No, my friend, no, no, it's not. It is definitely not that big of a deal. I agree with you. And it is definitely, definitely, hands down, not a big enough deal for the local Miami Police Department to show up on the scene just like this.
For our audio listeners, she's showing a clip of Miami Police Department racing to this mall. And on screen, there's probably well over a dozen cop cars racing on the highway.
Yeah, it's the whole department.
Yeah, so basically.
And the clip says at least 75 police cars called over teenagers fighting near downtown Miami shopping district.
Right? That seems like a lot of officers to show up, but my friends, that is not anywhere near all that came. And once you understand and you hear the eyewitnesses' stories, I believe you will at that point understand a little bit better as to why so many police officers, probably 100, along with choppers, black choppers from the PD, patrolling the scene from above. And according to witnesses, eyewitnesses there, the Miami police was not dispatched there for a juvenile fight. And the obvious need for such an enormous police presence is far more sinister than what we've been told. As multiple witnesses claimed to have seen, I can't believe I'm going to say this, creatures that stood 8 to 10 feet tall, walking outside and even inside of the mall. And the pew-pews that were reported, and even the pew-pews you might hear in some of the videos, had nothing to do with the juvenile fight. According to these witnesses, it was actually the mall-goers shooting to protect themselves from these 8 to 10 foot tall creatures in self-defense.
Okay, again, for our audio listeners, showing video clips of outside the mall, see a few crowds of people out there, and the clip says, witness claimed they saw creatures or beings walking at the mall. Black helicopters are now also on the scene.
See, I don't see anything. Yeah, this is a good video here.
Yeah, and then of course we're seeing like just absolute crazy police presence.
Like, that's nuts.
Along with the ridiculously high number of police officers that arrived on the scene and the helicopter flying above.
Apparently. Okay, I can't stand her. I think she just repeats herself.
Okay. So yeah, babe, we can stop there. I mean, basically, same thing. More clips of people taking shots. You hear gunshots from outside or inside the mall. We don't see any images of any 8 to 10 feet tall creatures.
I saw one, kind of, because I did the whole, you know, search Miami and Twitter and see what comes up, and I went through as few as I could find in about 10 minutes, and there was one where it claimed they you could see the thing, and there was a thing, but right. That's I couldn't, you know, it's like, oh, a blob. No, it moved, but the resolution is absolutely garbage and you can't tell anything, but
it always is though.
Yeah, it's like it's always like what are we not seeing? That's the story, right? And here it's like, okay, you have that many cops, it's a mall full of people, and there's no footage, nothing on Google, nothing on like on Twitter.
Well,
like,
apparently, so
literally, it's like the war in Ukraine.
This is with cardboard guns. This is so apparently I've heard reports of them confiscating phones, there was a blackout, like they literally cut power in the area. Like a whole bunch of stuff was going on in Miami all in one shot. They stopped flights out of Miami for a period of time. Like, these are all confirmable, confirmable things. And yet, no major media coverage. Look, even if we want to go with these are teenagers with machetes, not sticks, and that's why you had to have that much of a media presence, police presence. Like,
that's
like anything. Weird. Anything would be, any narrative would be interesting at this point. But the fact we're getting none is also very interesting. Cryptos, what do you think?
Well, aliens, Nephilim,
until I had logged on. It's funny, for somebody who writes about politics, I don't generally follow the news, which is crazy. I'm on Twitter all the time, and so the news kind of finds you. But it's one of those things where, like, I don't really comment on the news a lot this way. So I'm often looking at trying to see bigger patterns and so forth. Right. So, but at the same time, I have always had an interest in arcane stories that way, just because there is a lot in kind of conventional knowledge of things that elides a lot of oddities, right? So, you know, the whole, you know, Plato and Atlantis, the Graham, what's his name again?
Hancock.
That's right. And
Tartaria.
That's right. And
yeah, all this stuff. Yeah.
There a lot of his stuff is fascinating, right? So I tend to be of the mind that of looking back to the older Christian tradition, which generally held to the idea that a lot of what we account for today as aliens and so forth were actually fallen angels, right? So you have the fall into sin. Angels were established or created to as you know, I mean, that's what the term means, and I'm drawing a blank again too. So the angel is somebody, a messenger, right? So they, in that sense, are God's messenger. So they administer the will of God in creation. So they were set over places, over tribes, over people, over regions. And some of these angels, instead of passing worship on to the Most High God, took it, what didn't belong to them, for themselves, right? So this worship, and so they embraced you know, the sin of Satan that way, of pride, of accepting worship and so forth. But they had roles in administering things. So there is the theory, the idea that it was angels that taught men how to use tools and farm and do all the rest of these things, which in many ways, given the story, seems very credible, right? And then like Hancock's always saying too, like, you know, why is it that the pyramids arrive at a peak and then decline afterwards? Now, if you look at, say, somebody like Spengler, that kind of makes sense in a sense, because you hit the sort of the peak generative period of a culture. And then from there, you know, you have that long decline period, right?
Like where we're headed.
Right. Yeah. So,
so what you're saying is these are for sure Nephilim.
If you were to make me sort of sit on a sense of sort of what is happening, yeah, that would be where I would go in a sense where, you know, and the best theories that I have a sense sort of with both the church fathers, the older sort of tradition, is that the Nephilim are the result of demons breeding with human beings under very sort of dark arts, and they produce giants. So they're like Schwab, I believe, in his Substack a while ago, did there have been stories going back several hundred years of giants in the Americas, of small, of them cropping up here and there. So it's not like these things have ever disappeared, you know, like the Salem stuff. You know, there are sometimes where there is smoke, there is fire that way. And so things like this do leak out, and the satanic is real. The demonic is real. These, you know, like we say to people, there's two problems that you get with the demonic. One is to get too focused on it, where you become so focused in noticing and fighting demons that you give the demons all your attention when your intention should be going to God. And the other is to ignore the demonic entirely, which is a lot of what we've done since the rise of the Enlightenment and, you know, the philosophical materialism as it's taken over. Is that people have just sort of, well, it's not scientific, it can't be real, it's all just your imagination and so forth. But increasingly these days, people are beginning to come to the conclusion that, you know, many of these things, when you trace them back, it's, you know, it's demons all the way down. Right. And that's, and so what you're seeing, I think, with these types of things is as our culture begins to unravel, as people, you know, begin to open themselves up to quote unquote spirituality, right? They begin looking at, opening themselves up to the demonic. And in so doing, it would not shock me that, you know, there are 10-foot demon spawn wandering around Miami, like, it doesn't surprise me these days. And it's sort of like, well, you know, signs of the times.
All right. That's cool that you would go that literal with it. Cause just to go back a step, I mean, if we're referring to something like the Nephilim, this is, for anyone who's not familiar with the topic, this is the Book of Enoch, if I remember correctly.
But also in Genesis as well, too, mentioned.
It's in Genesis as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Genesis 6.
And they obviously materialized. The demons would have had to materialize in some way and then took human women, and then the Nephilim were their offspring. And then I don't know the story specifically, but
basically the idea was that fallen angels, like angels became enamored with mortal
human women.
For your listeners, if they want to really deep dive this stuff from an Orthodox Christian perspective, there's a phenomenal podcast, Lord of Spirits. Guys have spent the last couple of years walking through this stuff. And just start at the beginning and just work your way through it. 3 hours a pod. But they will, you know, and even coming from a Reformed Protestant perspective, somebody like myself who's open to the Orthodox tradition, I found they really do the work biblically. So there's a lot of things, you know, like, you know, why do the Israelites engage in, you know, like wars of genocide in the Old Testament? Well, if you trace back, you know, the Stephen DeYoung from there, he does work sort of tracing back the names of these tribes and makes the argument that many of these tribes that are wiped out are tribes that engage in this human demonic ritual mating, and, you know, like Goliath, right? These types of things, right? So you have these tribes that engage in these detestable acts, and sort of the only response if they don't repent, because I think there was a few instances noted where they do repent and they're allowed to live, but in instances where they don't repent, they literally have to be wiped out, every man, woman, and child. Because
I believe Christ even forgives one, and because he's, again, because the Nephilim in question, both repents, and I believe it's in, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's in the Gospels where Christ forgives essentially a Nephilim woman who comes with a pure heart. Like, that's repentance is such a central theme to these things that it can't be ignored. That, you know, even the Nephilim, even beings born out of unholy unions, still have souls. Like they're still in God's vision, so they also can be saved. It's that's the more kind of powerful. Oh no, sorry, it was a Canaanite woman. Sorry,
the woman Canaanite Nephilim.
Yeah, well, no, but they are related. Yeah, she was born with a. Well,
but I like that you brought up that bringing up that idea though is that our so because my beef with sort of the old books like that is, I'm like, why don't we ever see it anymore? Because you'd like to take all this stuff very seriously, but why did all the cool stuff just stop happening 2,000 years ago? Like, where are the angels? Aren't they showing up to people? Where are the
right. Well,
this is what I was going to say, because you mentioned something about there being recent occurrences of giants in the U.S. Whereas I've heard about like the burial mounds and things like that. I know there's like the teams, but I didn't know that this is actually something that's been occurring. And do these kind of like mystical, demon related, turning, you know, are demons mating with human women? Is this
and the argument has been like too, like this is like the Bigfoot sightings and stuff, right? Are interwoven with this. It's one of these questions, and this is one that has lived with me for a long time too, is, again, if this was the case in the old stories, why aren't we seeing it today? Because especially in the Gospels, there were the promises that, you know, Christ died so that the Spirit could be poured out, so that you could once again, in that sense, walk into the Holy of Holies, right? That's kind of that book of in the book of Hebrews, so that we can come into God's presence. And 2 Corinthians 3, you know, it's the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And now we approach God with unveiled faces. And so there's this sense that because of Christ, we can go up to the mountain like Moses did, and we can see God the way that Moses did, and we can do it with unveiled faces, right? And then, you know, that passage in 1 Corinthians where the Spirit of God reveals the heart of God, and you know, we learn spiritual things with spiritual thought, and all these types of things. So there's this real sense in Jesus, in John 15:16 says, you know, that whatever you don't know, you trust, the Spirit will teach you. And so there's this real profound sense, and you have this apostolic age where miracles are occurring, visions are happening. God meets Paul on the road to Damascus, and you're wondering, well, why did all these things stop? Well, they don't stop. There really are the stories of these things continue. The institutional church after the Montanist heresy had a really uncomfortable relationship with, you know, the Holy Spirit movements, in a part because they don't know what to do with it. So you have the story of Montanus is he was very critical of the mainstream church, in a sense, because he was saying that prophecy was ceasing and people were not, so that, and that was because of the lack of passion. And he argued that, you know, there were true Christians who were, you know, prophetic and so forth, but eventually went off the deep end, claimed himself to be Christ himself, condemned as a heretic, but his followers lived on, this new prophecy movement lived on for quite some time.
Sorry, and when around was this guy? I've never heard of this.
300s, 350s.
Oh, wow. Okay. So this was very like original.
Early. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so just around the time of Constantine and so forth, right? So the church eventually kind of says that well, that was sort of the thing for the apostolic age. We now have the succession of apostles. We have the teaching of the church, and we have the hierarchy to guard the teaching. We no longer need that kind of prophecy, right? But the scriptures don't really say that that's really what happens. But in a sense, the institutional church is in some ways, as it distances itself from the apostolic age, has always had an uncomfortable relationship with spirit movements, revival movements, and so forth. And so there's a lot of times where you see revival movements tend to get so far, and then they get co-opted, they run out of energy or so forth, and then mm-hmm. they evaporate, disappear, right? Or sometimes they're dismissed as heretics, and then and so forth. But so the stories are there of miracles, of saints who meet God, of the spirituals, very devout men, mystical. And the stories are there all down through the ages. You can hear the miracles and all of these kinds of things. But what really happens then is, I don't know how familiar you are with both James's The Bicameral Mind and Ian McGilchrist's The Master and His Emissary, and both of those two works, the idea of split brain theory, that we have one half of our brain that is attuned to intuitive knowledge, taking things in, processing metaphor, the mystical, and so forth. And then we have another side of our brain that takes a lot of this stuff in, and it rationalizes it, systematizes it, turns it into language, makes it clean, neat, repeatable, logical, so that it can be talked about easily or whatever, but then it loses all of the nuance, right? So the argument goes that McGilchrist made, that what James said is that as the West emerged and as we rationalized, we just simply lost the ability to see the supernatural and the spiritual anymore. And what McGilchrist says is that it's still there, but because our society has so balanced the rational side of our brain, rational knowing, what can be measured and observed and reasoned and talked about with language and numbers, because we've so biased ourselves towards this, we have become so unbalanced that we can no longer that we have a great difficulty now. Just it's almost like a state of mental imbalance, right? We've simply lost touch with these older wisdom traditions, with the archetypal, with the supernatural that's out there. So that's one of the things that I have argued, is that the part of this whole notion of returning to a flourishing, or not returning, but becoming again a flourishing society, means learning how to, on a physical and a material way, integrate our own brain structure back again, so that we can learn how to receive the mystical, the spiritual, the archetypal, the supernatural. But we can also integrate that real content into our life to recover this idea of the wisdom of God again, that the ancients very much, very clearly understood and knew about, in many ways understood way better than we do how that works. And so we tend to lean on rational systems, whereas in the older days, they leaned on wise men who had been in touch with God. Right. Yeah. And that's kind of that dividing line. So for me, that's part of, you talk about, you know, post-right, post-left, you know, the emergence of, so what happens is now as our society decays and as we no longer fear the demonic and we give ourselves over all to all of these perversions and so forth, is now you're seeing all this supernatural nonsense in a bad way starting to rear its head, because people, without realizing, are giving themselves over to the demonic. And as a result, you're seeing demonic manifestations. And it doesn't surprise me that it's occurring more and more frequently.
I think that's a good veering off point. Mark, before you make any more comments, I'll just get to a few housekeeping points. We have a $2 super chat from King Pilled, Matt Erickson. Cryptos on 2-bit. What's up, you goofy Canucks? I believe that's $2 American, so it might be worth only about 50 cents in about a week from now. We're not exactly sure what's going on with that currency, but we appreciate it either way.
Yeah, we're dealing you're still converting to Canadian, so.
Yeah,
exactly. Well,
$1,000.
Yeah. In a sense, wiping out a clan could mean converting them. The identity of a clan intimately tied to the clan's rituals. If everyone in a clan forsook the rituals, the clan would be, Yeah, there is something to that in that regard. It could mean both, right? I mean, many of these stories are so old, it's hard to know one way or the other. But I mean, it's certainly, you know, when you read the stories, the commands that God gives are very, very clear. And sometimes the Israelites sin because they want to keep some of the gold themselves. They want to keep some slaves or whatever, right? Or livestock. That's what undoes Saul's ministry, right? Is that he refuses to, you know, he keeps all the livestock, saying he's going to give a sacrifice to God. And God said, well, no, I just wanted you to kill them all.
Right.
And to our modern ear, that seems very, very harsh. But when you're dealing with the reality of demonic entities manifesting themselves, you know, if the argument is cogent, and I think the argument that Stephen DeYoung makes on the Lord of Spirits podcast is very cogent, that this was something necessary that had to be done, because this is what, you know, in a sinful world, when you have demonic entities doing these types of things, they really can't be tolerated because of the corrupting influence. It's like a cancer on humanity that has to be sort of cut out.
That touches even into Julius Evola when Julius Evola writes in Ride the Tiger and a few of those books that mm-hmm. that his concept of the disassociated man, the man of prehistory, the man who's always going to be somewhat of the outs, that archetype, must possess the will to do what must be done without passion or without wanting or not wanting it, just to simply do. Right, to be almost pure praxis in some level is something that he writes quite a bit about, and I think we're going to have to see a more resurgence of that, where it's no longer going to be just on a purely ideological or even spiritual lines. It has to come down to the essence of man and what that actually means in the modern era. If we've been denatured from our nature, we've been removed from critical parts of it. We must not just refine it, but also inhabit it in ways that we haven't in hundreds of years. Like, I don't know, so pre-Enlightenment, probably even further before that, because there had to be a degradation that led to the Enlightenment in the first place. In order for the Enlightenment to even be attractive to mm-hmm. think about or to try to enact, there had to be some sort of degradation socially, spiritually, etc., that got us to that point where suddenly this new thing is far more attractive than everything you've known from prehistory.
Well,
do you think?
Okay, go ahead, Mark.
I was going to ask a question following onto Jay's statement that I feel like that supposes that the Enlightenment is inherently oppositional to mysticism. I mean, it is in a sense, but I kind of see, like, maybe sociologically at the time it was that shiny new object. And I feel like, I don't know where I heard it, but the someone had said, like, in order to understand something, you need to have a word for it. And having the word for a thing allows you to conceptualize it. And it feels like, yeah, when we went down the Enlightenment path, pursuing the physical scientific explanation for everything, we lost the vocabulary for the metaphysical, and that it could still be there, but we're blind to it because we're just so in one direction.
Well, that's part of what even the word the Enlightenment is itself a form of propaganda,
right,
to elevate that era of time, right?
That we were all, it was all dark before, and now we can see where it
could that be, that's right. The opposite, so you're right? You're discounting what went on before. So I have some pet theories, and this is one of the things about being older and not, you know, that some of the younger guys have the advantage, you know, when they're reading and writing, that they're young and they're doing more scholarship. The stuff is fresher to them, but I've just read a ton of stuff and end up forgetting much of what I remember. And then, so sometimes I get in the middle of these debates and I'll say things and they'll go like, where did you get that from? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. I just picked this up in a couple books I read 35 years ago. You know what I mean? Right,
exactly.
So some of these things, so one of my understandings is that there was a decisive break that occurred. And this is why I'm very open to Spengler's understanding of history of the West beginning around the period 1000, and cultures having this kind of, you know, birth, youth, adulthood, and then old age and dying sort of cycle. Right. Mm-hmm. in that around the year 1000, there was a great millenarian hope. There was an expectation that Christ would return, right? Now, nobody knew the day or hour or the time, but there was this sense that at the year, you know, 1000 years, because to the Lord, 1000 years is a day and all these types of things, right? So there was this sense that about the year 1000 that Christ would return, and then he didn't, right? So,
why 1K?
Yeah, why 1K? So the Christ does not return in the year 1000. And I've heard it said that there was a kind of break that occurred. So prior to that, this is something that Mircea Eliade talks about in the myth of the eternal return, right? So there in the pagan era and in the pre-Christian era, the notion of history was very cyclical, archetypal, right? So, but these archetypes are very real, present for people, like the world, the creation out there, it has meaning, right? So you become a man by becoming a man like David or like Achilles. So you live into the stories because these archetypes there of the good king, the good farmer, the good wife, all of these archetypes are out there, and you become who you are by living into the archetypes. And in some ways, divine law is itself a form of archetype, and you live into the archetype and you become, you know, who you are, right? And but in this case, it's very cyclical, and you can even see it in the scriptures that there in the Old Testament, there's a lot of archetypal sort of patterning going on, right? So King Josiah is put forward as a second Moses, right? Types of things. And there's other archetypal things. So you see these repetitions in the way that stories are told, right? So Joseph is a form of Christ figure in that regard. And the book of Matthew is very good at picking out these archetypes and folding them in and say Jesus is the fulfillment of all the arch. He is the archetypal man, right? Now in the Christian era, we get into a notion. We talk about it in terms of history, idea of linear history, but it's not really linear history. So you have this idea of creation, redemption, fall, everything happening within it, and it moves from a beginning to an end. But human beings are not the central actor, right? So you think of it as a static superstructure, God's eternal will from the beginning to the middle in Christ, you know, the fall. Everything is happening within God's architecture, his frame. So the primary actor in history is not human beings, but it's God, right? So the idea is then that Christian salvation comes as a form of consolation, we might say, in a sinful world that we don't really solve the problems. We don't solve the problems of poverty, but basically we do the best we can by living into the archetypes, by living into God's law, by following the rituals, and finding our place in the social hierarchy, all of these things. And in so doing, we make society the best that we can make it, and we have the consolation of the gospel for the things that have gone wrong and for the sufferings that we still have to endure. But we know that the outflowing history is in the hands of God and that Christ will return. So then if, let's say, you have this psychic break in the year 1000 where Christ doesn't return, right? And then at the same time, you know, very shortly thereafter, Aristotle's discovered, humanism bursts out. So all of a sudden now man becomes the central actor for a lot of people. And this is this notion of humanism that we then begin to, that we as human beings determine history. And so you have this gradual process, at least this is my argument anyways, where in the West is about breaking free. And that's that Spenglerian idea of the Faustian man trying to break free from constraints. And the main constraint that he's trying to break free from is the constraint of the church. Now, he's born within a Christian, the West is born within a Christian society, and it's colored with Christianity. But what you see then is this gradual moving from this hierarchy of waiting for God's action to mankind increasingly grabbing hold of its own action. So then, what is it, 1150s, Abelard with Psychic Non and the introduction of nominalism fundamentally breaks with Plato. So with Plato, you had the forms, you had the metaphysical structures of the universe. something is big or small, not because it's you see it relative to each other, but it's in because it adheres to the concept of bigness or smallness. Something is two because it adheres to the concept of two-ness, right? And so they ascribe to these metaphysical realities. And then as you switch to into this sort of nominalist area, as they embrace Aristotle, all of a sudden now you don't have this web of being or whatever, too. You have this understanding that everything are isolated monads, right? That then we as human beings put meaning onto, you know, and the decisive break, then of course the Enlightenment comes with Kant, who makes the argument that you can't actually apprehend, you can't see the metaphysical realm, you have to assume it a priori. And so that sort of makes way for the scientific and with all of these things. So now you end up with an ethics. Well, what I do in my own bedroom doesn't matter because I'm not, you know, I'm not connected to anybody else. So what is it? What is anybody else's business? What I do in my own bedroom, to somebody who was in the 600, they would be appalled at that, you know,
right?
Because you were connected in a web of being. What you did in your own bedroom definitely mattered because you and I are connected in this web of being. So nominalism flips that on its head. And now and then as you increasingly materialize the world, you know, as you get this new learning and science comes in, as Aristotle takes over, as this Enlightenment empiricism and the new learning takes over, now all of a sudden or eventually you have us as human beings bearing the responsibility for giving meaning to the world. And this is what Eliade calls, you sort of bear the burden of history now. So now it falls upon us to be the vehicle of salvation, the vehicle of God's work in the world. So if utopia is going to be realized, it's because we as human beings take the bull by the horns and we manufacture it on behalf of God, right?
Right.
And
right.
This is kind of that shift. So then, you know, everything becomes immanentized. And as a result, there is a break, a cutting off from God. So you know, God continually grows more and more distant. We have this introduction of the ideas of creation, of you know, natural laws. You know, so God is the great watchmaker. He just sets everything in motion and goes. And then this notion of deism, that, you know, God is far off, he sets everything in motion, but we really don't expect God to work in creation. So now, even though we have the word of God, God talks to us, but we really don't expect God to interact in our lives. So in many ways, our understanding of God is almost theoretical rather than actual. Whereas in the year 300 per se, you know, people lived immersed in a web of divine presence everywhere. So when we talk about, you know, what will post-Western world look like, part of it will be rediscovering perhaps or re-embracing that living tradition within our faith of God being very, very real in our lives in a way that he isn't right now. God not being distant and the deist thing far off, but God being, you know, people actually fear and, you know, fear and trembling before the Lord, because very few people today actually fear the Lord because they don't actually believe that he's going to return. And so if you don't believe that God's going to return, why would you be afraid of his judgment, right? So all of these things become more theoretical than actually reality. And then if you rationalize theology, and I'm kind of going on here, as you rationalize theology, then everything you do about the faith is talking about God. So we talk about God ad nauseum, but do we actually, and that's the open question for our era, is do we actually encounter God anymore? And that's really, and I think that's where you're seeing people, you know, embracing the Orthodox faith, is because the Orthodox kind of sidestepped this whole Western period of rationalizing the Enlightenment and everything else. And there is this sense, if I go into an Orthodox church, I can still actually encounter God here, because these people do this and they've been doing it now for 1,000, 2,000 years in a way that we haven't been for the last 1,000.
It pigeonholes into something I've said and popularized on the show, which is the ritual and the ritual and the reality are one. So if we think of if we look at, let's say, the Orthodox Church and the Calvinist Church, to an outsider, they're pretty much the exact same. Of course, people inside of those two churches understand there are differences.
Massive differences.
Right, exactly. Because as you zoom out, you start to see those differences metastasize a lot more. Maybe the better example would be like Orthodoxy versus Roman Catholics. Like, most people wouldn't even make that discernment. But each church in this case live in their own reality. And the major difference between those two realities are their rituals. That which we ritualize creates and substantiates a reality, and that reality demands more rituals to substantiate and create that reality. So the ritual and reality are one. That which we ritualize creates and maintains the reality in which we live in. When we're talking about some things like truth, capital T truth, that despite what a denomination or differences or, you know, differences in ritual, they all have to correspond to that meta absolute truth, to that ultimate reality, which we would say is God. If it doesn't correspond to that, it will just lead you astray. It'll lead you into predictable errors and dead ends and failures. Because we can fail even when we are adhering to let's say the natural order, to God, but at least there's a chance of redemption, a chance of getting up, a chance of advancing, a chance of getting it right, if we want to put it that way. Whereas if you're outside of it or trying to create your own reality without God present in it, it's just constant failure. You know, there's the consequences of your actions just begin to build up and build up and build up. And I think maybe this is a good time to switch into political theory, but certainly I think this is what we're seeing in the West, that the cumulative effect of consequences based on policy that is trying to solve for problems that cannot be solved for, let's say poverty or IQ or, you know, general ability. Yeah, COVID, life itself, life and death itself. Liberalism has attempted to solve these problems. And because they're unsolvable, they're just creating more and more problems as they go. And conservatives are just as much to blame for this as your craziest blue-haired liberal.
Well, that's the thing is that... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, so finish your comment. I'll just do a little house cleaning. Don't forget to like, subscribe, share the video. We have memberships here on YouTube. You can join our Patreon and our Substack as well. I will be doing more and more work there starting next week. So sign up, $2 memberships. We will, after the end of this conversation, at least Mark and myself, if not Kryptos as well, will be doing a post-show wrap-up. And if anyone wants to get in there and have a conversation with us, you're more than welcome to. We love each and every one of you. Thank you so much for supporting the show. Of course, we've had this gigantic surge in interest over the last year. We want to continue that and produce more interesting content and stuff for you folks. So again, appreciate it. Sorry, Kryptos, I just had to do that little bit of house cleaning. Where do you want to pick up from what I just said?
Well, what's interesting is when you look at, you know, one of the things you realize very quickly as you get into things politically is that there really is no conservative movement. Like there is no conservative in the West today. That conservatism really died with the rise of industrialism. Once you get past the age of enclosure in England, especially in English society, American society, that it's in many ways variations of liberalism all the way down, right? So whether it's classical liberalism, a quote-unquote fiscal conservative, you might want to better say a fiscally responsible politician is still who believes in the market economic, you know, the kind of free market economics is still basically a liberal, right? An economic liberal. And one of the big dividing lines in many ways is this dividing line between, do you believe in the fundamental goodness of humanity, or do you believe that human beings are fundamentally flawed? So the teaching of original sin, because a lot of stuff kind of flows back and out of that, right? If you believe that people are born basically blank slates or born good, then, you know, as Rousseau argued, then it follows naturally that if we can clean up all of the structures in society and reorganize them and educate people properly, we can allow their innate goodness to emerge, right? This is kind of the Star Trek vision of the world, right? We just basically, if we tackle all of the basic issues like poverty and energy production and privation, then people's basic goodness will emerge naturally. And you know, the whole notion of the market economy, the free market economy, is if we just allow people the freedom to make their own choices and don't try to control them through, you know, government or whatever other means, that people will just in aggregate will make the decisions that are in their best interests, and it will all work out for the best. But if people are fundamentally sinful and they make corrupt and selfish and destructive and decisions that are basically predatory on other human beings and so forth, that they will very quickly, the world will very quickly spiral into a very bad place. So if people are greedy, if they are, willing to duplicitous and willing to use power for power's sake, not for the good necessarily, but for their own betterment, then all of these things run aground very, very quickly, right? So in the Middle Ages, when you recognize that people were sinful and that there's nothing you could do about the sinfulness, Christ has taken care of it. You do the best you can, and you do what's necessary in terms of like social violence or whatever to stem evil. But you recognize that you're never getting rid of it, and that, you know, as a person, you're part of the whole system because you're forced to use violence to maintain order, right? So there's that whole web that way. What happens to us in the West, though, with technology, and this is something that Jacques Ellul argued, is that technology is neither good nor evil, but it's also not neutral, right? He argued that technology and technique, and he wasn't thinking just of devices, but technology is a way of thinking, of a kind of systematized, rational way of approaching things. You know, policy frameworks, the Walmart way, the McDonald's way, you know, these types of things where you take a process, you abstract it, you know, Taylor's time and motion studies, and then you apply it back and fit people into it rather than, the sort of the tools and the people being the most important thing. And with technology, Ellul argued, is that because it's ambivalent, it has good things that come with it, it has bad things that come with it. And typically the goods are realized at the beginning and the evils follow later. So if we try to fix society, like to engineer societies, if it's a technology, what happens, Ellul argues, is that as we begin to apply these technical solutions to our problems, they will bring some goods, and oftentimes we'll get we'll realize the goods very quickly at the beginning, but then the ills that come from those techniques will begin to realize themselves later. So then we try to solve that with a new set of techniques, and then that creates another set of goods that then also generates another set of evils, and it begins to expand exponentially, right? So we get to where we go, but you never actually get rid of any of the ills. You have some goods, you have some ills, but increasingly society becomes more and more complex. The problems become more and more complex. And the more that you try to fix them, the worse that things overall get, until you have the sense of hopeless despair that you never can fix anything, right?
Right. Trade-offs with a spiraling negative outcome.
Yeah, but it's not just negative, because you have to argue with every technology and every technique, there are positives that come with it. There's a reason why people introduce them, is because they think they're going to get some benefit from it, right?
Yeah, well, they think they're going to solve the suffering. Or something.
That's right.
Like, and trying to look at it meta.
Poverty.
Yeah, exactly.
Sam Harris once said, I think, something very revelatory, that he believes that suffering is intolerable, that the existence of suffering in the world is a great wrong that needs to be corrected, needs to be solved for.
It's true, but which solution are you choosing? Like, because we're always trying to, and when I was thinking about this episode, I was trying to even conceptualize what conservatism is, because I know it's what it's not. I know it's not what we have now. And I'm trying to even think back to the past as an example of what it was, or something that we could emulate. And going back to what you were saying about living archetypally, this is something that really became stark to me, especially during COVID, was when you remove the sort of metaphysical archetype, we seem to naturally replace it with something else. And that's where you get the idea of like the right side of history. people being, you're going to be judged one way or another, but they're being judged in this very, like, as if you can correct the world and make heaven on earth, which is not the Christian sort of ethos, but people tend to mimic it, even if it's incorrectly. And so maybe conservatism is the alternative to that, which is reinstalling the correct metaphysical structure around the way we prioritize what it is that we want in this earth, and it's not paradise.
Well, this is interesting because, like, recently I was writing over at my Substack, Seeking the Hidden Thing. So I can, you know, seekingthehiddenthing.com. That's a thing. So there is a piece over there called Building a Parallel Polity, Sketching Out the Road Ahead. And one of the things, you know, argue that technology is in many ways kind of like human sinfulness. Right? Once you have the knowledge and once it's there, you can't get rid of it because it gives you a sense of power. Right? Power to harness nature, power to harness society, but the power to control and the power to make money, right? So people are going to use, so you're going to never be able to sort of get away. But the other thing that technique does is it allows you to govern at scale. So nations on the size of the United States or the global community, these are, you know, global logistics and supply chains. These are only possible through technique. So it's not going to go away. So we have this problem where what we call, what I've labeled the tank problem, right? So if you're going to be a people group and you want to say, let's try something completely new. We're going to get rid of technology or whatever. The problem is that your neighbor hasn't, and he's got assembly lines with tanks rolling off them. And if you don't solve the tank problem, right, either figure out how to stop your neighbor's tanks or develop some tanks yourself, you're going to get overrun with tanks. And this is kind of the problem with technology is that sooner or later, because the knowledge is out there, somebody's going to use it. He said, well, why is like 99.9% of the human population getting rid of technology? This stuff is super powerful. Why don't we use it? And he grabs it and then dominates the world again, right? So this is kind of the, so you have to understand that you have to rejig our relationship with technology such that we use it in a way that it's non-utopian. That is, in a sense, what we were talking earlier, that there's this kind of necessity about it. So we use it because it's necessary, and we do it because we have to, but we don't necessarily like the fact that we have to. It's sort of the lesser of two options, but we do it anyways. Right. And the idea is that we're always trying to emphasize not so much the system or the tool or the technology, but we're trying to push to a point where, like the old use of tools, where the decisive thing was the skill, the ability, the wit, the creativity of the tool user, right? And that's kind of the, you know, and the same thing for laws. You know, we're trying to have laws where it doesn't come down to the 1,000-page policy manual where we always can have the right answer, but we have people with wisdom who are able to interpret a small set of socially embedded rules that can then answer a wide range of problems with, you know, because they live before the face of God, so to speak, they have wisdom in the moment to give the answers that we need for questions. They don't have to write a 1,000-page policy manual, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's all of these things in a sense of disentangling ourselves from the modern world, but we can't entirely get away from it, right? Yeah. So, you know, you talk about commitment to place, a reduction of scale, a commitment to the human. All of these things are part of building communities that are, in a sense, post-Western. So it's not necessarily, I don't know if we can reject it necessarily, but we can just simply, and Vaclav Havel did this thing where he talked about, everybody wants to be an anti-communist, right? But he says, by becoming an anti-communist, you've defined yourself by communism. Right. So that's one of the things that I try to do is to urge people is don't become anti-Western, don't be anti-leftist, don't be anti-rightist. But the idea is for us in terms of a post-right world or a post-Western world is to begin thinking of, well, what is the right thing that brings about a flourishing society, given what we know about what created this global monstrosity in the first place that we can now get away from it, right? Go ahead.
Sorry, just to quote yourself here, because you were asked on X recently, what will a post-right look like? And you responded, it will be Christian. It will not be the corporate mega church Protestantism of today, but rather a faith which has reconnected with its own living tradition through the mystical. Men will once again go up the mountain, meet God, and return the clear, thus says the Lord.
Yeah, and that's what frightens people, right? That's what really, really scares. This is a thing also that technique does is, you know, sort of in a pre-technique world where technique takes over, you rely on human beings, but it's lumpy, right? So if you have great human beings, things are going great. If you have skilled people, it goes great. But if you have duplicitous, greedy, you know, poor quality leaders or whatever, society goes bad. So what does technique do? It allows you to systematize these processes to create consistent outputs. So you raise the floor of your administration. It's very powerful, right? Because this is how you run large businesses. You create, but you raise the floor. You're no longer dependent because you can slot pretty much any person in. You can train them, right? And that's how things work. And you can train them in the proper way to do things. And this is how our government works. Now they follow the systems, they follow the rules, they follow the policies, and they execute the policies, and they create a very high, people don't realize what a high standard of administration our government works and just the vast scale of it. But what you lose in that is it's no longer human anymore, right? You miss those high peaks of great men. Because the cost of creating a high floor is you no longer have a high ceiling. The ceiling is brought down also to that high floor. And so for someone to be truly great, you know, it's like you say, like an Elon Musk, they almost have to completely and utterly smash up the whole idea of policy and system or whatever. And it's very hard for people to do. So in this sense, we have to re-embrace this kind of lumpiness. But so then you're relying on great people. Well, where does authority really come from? This is one of the problems that Western world hasn't been able to solve. And I don't think technological society can solve is when you look to biblical reality, where did authority come from, right? Well, Moses meets God at the burning bush. He goes up the mountain and he meets God. Abraham goes up the mountain when he sacrifices his son and meets God on the mountain, right? You know, Paul meets Jesus on the road to Damascus. God comes down and meets us in the form of Jesus. So there's this sense that authority, real authority, lies with the person. Now, it doesn't have to be the same kind of experience that Moses had. These stories are archetypal for a reason. But in a smaller way, our leader has to be someone who has that feel of a man who's gone up the mountain and met God. Right? Because this now lends him with the gravitas, the authority. He's a person who's trembled before God. He can see with God. And there's this wonderful little passage, and I give it to everybody in Proverbs. We're in back-to-back verses. It says, do not correct a fool, because if you do, you'll get caught up in his folly. Right? This is Proverbs 26, verse 4 and 5. And you think that's great. I've had conversations on Twitter that are like that. You know, you get caught up in fool. But the very next verse says, correct the fool or he will remain forever in his folly. And you've got two biblical verses back to back giving the opposite advice. And you're thinking, well, what's with the point? Like, what's with this, right? Then you realize is that the wise man who's gone up the mountain and met God in the moment that he confronts the fool and meets him will have the right answer. And there is nothing that the policy manual can do to account for this. This is what Schmidt was talking about and was trying to capture when he talked about the miracle of law. And you talk about the closed system of rationality to this Western law. He says, the thing is that you're going to meet a crisis for which your closed system of rationality cannot account for. And in that moment, the sovereign is the one who decides how to solve the problem, right? And so he talks about the older days, we understood that law itself was a miracle. It came from God. Where did it come from? Like Proverbs 29 or whatever, I think it is. That, you know, where is wisdom? Where can it be found? Well, God knows the way to it, right? So you go up the mountain, you meet God, and you have wisdom. Well, our modern world, especially the leftists, this terrifies the willies out of them. Nobody wants to put their hands in trust with somebody who says, thus says the Lord. Right. And so now we flounder about, right? But to me, this is where we're going to be going in the future is men and women who have this feel about them. Of somebody who's gone up the mountain. It might be warriors, it might be a priest, it might be a statesman, but you're going to have leaders that will emerge who will have this feeling of the genuine sense, you know, that this man, this guy has met God, and he has that feeling of real authentic wisdom. And we don't encounter that today. That's been in some sense cut off from us. And that's what what the Western world is cut off from us.
We don't have humility at all in the West. In fact, the entire system is built around sort of anti-humility. It's built around pride and vainglory. And those who are the most prideful tend to be those who are awarded the most. But I think what you're describing is like going almost like going up the mountain is going down in your soul. There's an inverted action in that. As you go up to meet God, you must also like humble yourself to that point when you almost have to crawl towards God, because there's a moment of I think in Revelation there's a moment of shame. There's a moment of meeting yourself before you meet him, and what you meet is usually not what you like, what you want to see. It is not the exalted version of yourself. It is not the ideal version of yourself. It is that fallen nature. It's that fallen man that only God can rise up. Like you're powerless to do it yourself.
Well, it's that whole thing of taking your shoes off on holy ground. And you see it even in a stripped down liturgy, like the Reformed liturgy, right? You have a call to worship, right? You come in, you sing a song of greeting, you come into the presence of God, God greets you, you sing a song of praise. But then what happens right after you've been invited to come into the presence of God, you've sung praises to him, God has blessed you. Now you stand before God and you stand before a holy God, and now you have the ritual of confession and assurance. Right. So God, then you see yourself as in need of grace, and then and the ritual then walks you through the process of confession and repentance and absolution and assurance of salvation again. But you go through that ritual each week in a service, right? It reminds you of that process of coming up the mountain again. And that's, I think you're absolutely right. And that's that sense of taking your feet off, you know, because you're standing on holy ground lest you die, right? And that was always that fear. I've met the Lord. Today, I'm surely going to die. And then there's, you know, do not be afraid. You know what I mean? You're going to be okay. That's right. And so the angel assures you, yeah, you're going to be fine. Don't worry about it. You're not going to die. But there's that sense that if you meet God, you're going to be consumed by his holiness. Because you are
Mark, not. Mark, any thoughts before we start wrapping things up?
Mark looks thoughtful over there.
I'm enjoying listening.
Let's get to some comments here. Zach Putnam, who's a new member and has gifted 5 2-bit podcast memberships. Thank you very much, Zach. Appreciate you. He says, tabula rasa is a patsy for people's natural accountability for their actions. I think when you start getting into different spiritual movements, what I find interesting is there's a lot of Westerners who are attracted to Buddhism and so that, and if you look at the core principles, some of those things seem to be interconnected, like this sort of like this desire for monadism, that all religions stem from the same kind of desire or source. But when you actually start getting deeper into these things, you understand that what they're promising often is a removal of responsibility, that this idea to be free of that the world is full of suffering, and you're trying to free yourself from suffering seems to be always the sort of the inversion point from Christianity, where Christianity is really about embracing the suffering, that you know our God suffered for us, our God humbled himself for us on the cross, and then that's where we get our divinity from. I don't know, Cryptus, if you want to go anything with that.
Well, I always say to people who say, well, you know, that Christianity has a fairly cogent argument for, you know, as we talked about earlier, that, you know, people began to worship the created angelic beings and so forth. But people who say, well, everybody's worshiping the same thing. And I said, well, all religious claims are religious claims. So our religious claim as Christians is a religious claim, but the claim that all religions are worshiping the same thing is as much a religious claim as my religious claim that salvation can only be found for Christ, and Christ is the true, you know, the triune God is the true God, God of gods, and that all others are pretenders, right? And so you can, this is one of the things why, you know, we have to deal with grapple with postmodernism, right? And they said, well, your claim is a claim. And so my claim is a claim, and you can't just simply dismiss my claim by saying, and that's what they're really trying to do by saying, well, you're all just part of the same. So then, you know what I mean? And now they're trying to say, I don't have to take your claim seriously. Right. And so I'm saying, no, I have to take your claim seriously, but you also have to take my claim seriously. And if we're both on the same grounds, you have to evaluate your claim as a religious claim. And that's one of the things they often don't really want to do, that you're making the same kind of claim that you're trying to avoid making the same kind of claim I'm making by this kind of meta frame. And I'm saying, well, you can't do that because all claims are religious claims.
Are you sure you're Calvinist?
Because I am. A lot of people ask me that all the time, but it's one of these things where, you know, I think for myself too much, and I don't recite things. But I look back on it, and there's a lot of things where I am what I am. I'm a solid predestinarian too, as well. So I know that Orthodoxy struggles with the idea of Calvinist predestinarianism. So that's one of those things. There's a number of other questions where I'm probably more of a neo-Calvinist than I am a Calvinist. Like Dutch Kuiperianism. Right. So, but that's another whole, Tatiana, that's another whole hour right
yeah,
there.
Yeah. 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 Tatiana sent us $2 just because I love you guys. God bless. Thank you, Tatiana. We love you too. William Mignola has become a member for a month. Brody Alexander has become a member for a month. Mike Bergman sent us $5. I appreciate you guys. No homo for real, for real. We will take that under advisement there, Mike. Gentlemen, I'm going to play the outro music unless there's anything else we want to get to. Before I do, I'm going to play this outro. Sorry, Cryptos, this often takes the audio out for a second, so I'll just talk through that.
That's fine.
Because I love you and you at the same time. Thank you, sir. That was fantastic, man.
Very nice.
You know, that was really good. Thank you for letting me go on at length a couple times. I know that sometimes these things, you get big ideas and it's just, you try to explain everything. And I realize, like, oh my word, I'm just trying to explain everything. I got to stop somehow, but I've got this train going. And I'm like, how do I stop this thing that I've unleashed?
I will say this after this conversation. I hope this is the start of a very long and fruitful friendship between all three of us.
That'd be good.
And many others. We'd love to have you on A Friend or Fed, which is a panel show. If you haven't checked out our latest, it's our Santa Friend or Fed. With Thomas 77, Pete Quinones, and a whole bunch of Matt Erickson, Adam Fitzgerald.
That sounds like fun. I would love to do this again. I always have fun. I'm one of these people. I'm at base an introvert, and I spend a lot of time by myself, and I have a lot going on in my head. So once you break the dam, it tends to just all tumble out.
Get it out.
You gotta get it out. And I appreciate you guys just letting me ramble on for a bit. It was fun. So.
There was no point for us to jump in. Like you were killing him the entire time.
Well, there so, we like, go.
What
I appreciate.
What were we gonna say?
Yeah, exactly. Very Mark, good.
Right. I'm good. Thank you, group host. Thank you, everyone.
Talk to you later.
Have a good weekend.
Run for a second. We'll play out the outro. Sure. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much again. Thank you for all the support, love, memberships, and super chats. We will see you again next week. We have David Weiss lined up to talk sort of beyond the ice wall and a few other things. And then we have a few interesting things.
David Whitehead is confirmed for the 26th.
David Whitehead. Yeah. So pay attention to our Twitter posts, and we will keep you updated as far as we know. Appreciate you guys. Love you. And